Lessig says this corruption is different, as he puts it, crafted by good souls who come to politics with the best of intentions but get caught up in the need to raise money to stay in office. The result, he says, is politicians who start listening harder to those with cash, focusing on their priorities. Citizens without big dollars then withdraw from the process, feeling they're not being heard and losing trust in their democracy. In his book, Lessig offers guarded hope that this can change. Among his proposals, a constitutional convention on how to redeem our representational system of government. Today in The Exchange, Lawrence Lessig joins us, and let's hear from you. Do you see the problems that he outlines, or is it going overboard to say our republic is lost? How much are individual politicians accountable for corruption, and how much are they drawn in against their will into a corrupt system? Let us know what you think. Give us a call. The Exchange number 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Lessig, welcome. Good to have you.
Great to be here.
Well, you've long been known for your work in copyright law and internet freedom. You've been involved in big court cases surrounding this issue, major groups like the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Why the shift, Professor Lessig? Was there a single moment where you said, look, this money in politics thing is where I need to devote my energies and my attention right now? Was there a sudden moment, or was it more of a gradual feeling?
Well, it was a sudden moment that convinced me first that I wasn't as smart as I thought I was, because it was pretty obvious once I had this recognition. And the recognition was we were making lots of progress with the issues of copyright and IP among parents and educators and businesses and the general public. People were getting the issue and getting the need for change. But policymakers weren't at all. And it was obvious why they weren't at all, and that was because the other side in the debate wasn't even there, wasn't present. And it wasn't present because public domain didn't have a lobbyist and didn't have channels of money that it could pour into the political process. And after, you know, writing six books in the field, thinking things have been explained pretty clearly by me and lots of other people, there ought to be progress in the policy world, I recognized we needed to make progress in fixing the policy world before this issue and lots of other, you know, not so esoteric issues like global warming or healthcare, or you pick your case, the same dynamic exists. We weren't going to make progress until we could make progress with the corruption of our political system.
Yeah, and that's what you say in the book. You say we get so focused on the issue we care about, whether it's climate change or public schools or, you know, internet freedom. And that's all well and good, but you say, look, folks, we need to strike at the root of this first. Cut out the root, and then you can start solving these other problems.
That's exactly right. And I think that the critical insight people need to make is to connect the dots, to see how, you know, whatever their favorite issue is, they've got at least two or three other issues they care about. And then if they ask, why are all of these issues not making any progress? Why can't we seem to solve any of them? They'll begin to recognize what the underlying cause to this is.
So give us an example, Professor Lessig, if you could, please. You talked about your experience with internet freedom, but give us another example where if you're really focused on education or the environment or, you know, whatever, you need to look first at money in politics. Give us another example.
Well, I think the best example to focus on, really the most profound, is the financial services sector, right? So we suffered a collapse in 2008, as most people who are independent of Wall Street recognize and have written, because of the misregulation of Wall Street, in large part because of a series of changes in the rules that let them basically gamble with our money and get the upside when things went well, but we paid the downside when things went poorly. So, you know, a series of changes that both Democrats and Republicans supported beginning in the 1990s to deregulate these new financial innovations. That is bad enough. Much more dramatic, much more profound, is that after we had seen the consequences of this deregulation, after we had seen the consequences of the way we allowed financial services to be misregulated, after the dean of deregulation, Alan Greenspan, you know, said that he had been mistaken in his view about how the banks would behave, that they thought they would behave in the public interest, but it turned out they didn't. After all of that, Wall Street still had the power in the 2010 election to blackmail both the Democrats and the Republicans to get them to not change any of the fundamentals that had led to this collapse. So if the banks were too big to fail before 2008, they're only bigger today. They're only more likely to demand government bailouts if, in fact, their gambles go south. And they're still allowed to gamble. They're still allowed to engage in exactly the kind of behavior that led our economy to the brink of collapse just 3 years ago. Now, you know, again, it's one thing to think they were able to achieve this before 2008, when the kind of zeitgeist of the time was, let's deregulate everything. But the idea that after 2008, even then, they had that power is a profound measure of just how corrupt the system has become. And I think both left and right can look at that and be terrified about exactly what that says about this republic.
So you're saying both Democratic and Republican politicians caved, basically.
Had to cave. I mean, Wall Street was the number one group contributing to the 2010 election. And Wall Street signaled that if you don't back off from your threats to re-regulate and change the fundamentals of the way the system functions, we'll retaliate, was enough to make both sides recognize that they could not begin to be competitive in the 2010 election unless they accommodated Wall Street's demands, which, you know, is terrifying. It's the idea that our system allows us to be held hostage in that way is, I think, the clearest reason why we've got to do something to change it.
Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Our guest is Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard and a professor of law at Harvard Law School. He's the author of the new book that we're talking about this hour. It's called Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. Professor Lessig, just a quick question about that subtitle of your book, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. What about the White House? Are they scot-free here?
Well, I think that the White House raises different questions. I think that, you know, the interaction of the agencies and Congress and the way money plays into that interaction is also an important issue. But I really felt that in this area of reform, we have spent so much time focused on the presidency and not enough time focused on the second critical component to policymaking, what the framers thought would be the first critical component to policymaking, Congress. So I think that we've got to worry as well about how the president is selected. And I'm extremely excited to see one Republican candidate for president, Buddy Romer, who's launching a campaign where he says he wants to be able to be, quote, free to lead by not taking any more than $100 from anybody and taking no PAC money. So that, I think, is progress, and it's good to focus that in the context of the president. But if we don't solve the problem with Congress, it doesn't matter what we do with the president. So my focus has been trying to think about that branch.
Well, and there's only so much you can do in one book. And Buddy Romer, by the way, was on our program a couple months ago, former Louisiana governor, longtime congressman. So if listeners want to know more, they can go to our archives. You know, Lawrence, a lot has been written. A lot has been written concerning the influence of money in politics. There are groups that devote their whole lives to this issue. How is your take on this topic different? What do you hope to add to this ongoing conversation with this book?
Well, there are a couple things. The first is to get people to recognize the kind of corruption this is. You know, the Supreme Court, in its Citizens United decision, essentially defined corruption in such a narrow way that it made it almost impossible to imagine how Congress could address what is the core problem to our democracy right now. The court defined corruption to make it sound like all that it would recognize as, quote, corruption was quid pro quo bribery. And so one thing I was very keen to do in this book is to make it obvious why there are other corruptions that are just as problematic, indeed, I think more problematic than quid pro quo bribery. And the kind of corruption I was trying to get people to recognize here is not the corruption of bad people violating criminal laws, which, I'm sure it happens, but at the federal level is almost extinct. Instead, the kind of corruption I'm trying to get people to focus on is good people living within a system that systematically directs their attention away from the thing they were supposed to be focused on, what we the people want, and instead focused on what the funders want. So if you're spending 30% to 70% of your time raising money to get back to Congress, you can't help but become dependent upon, develop a sixth sense about, and constantly shapeshift in light of what you know your funders want. And that type of dependency upon funders, is directly in conflict with what the framers of our Constitution said they wanted to create, which was, as Federalist 52 puts it, a dependency upon the people alone. So that is a corruption relative to the system they originally envisioned, and it seems to me just as legitimate a target for reform as to avoid Rob Blagojevich's having their play with the field inside of an institution like Congress. So getting that clear and establishing that as corruption was, I think, one of the most central objectives of what I was trying to do in the book.
So systemic corruption, not somebody handing somebody a bag of cash and saying, here you go, more systemic stuff.
And if you think about it, I'm all against the bag of cash corruption. But relative to the cost of the systemic corruption, it's tiny. Just take the cost of the corruption that led to the financial collapse. Just that alone. Put aside global warming, healthcare, tax complexity, government, all those other issues. Just that one. The cost of that corruption, I think, dwarfs the cost of, the Randy Duke Cunninghams inside the system.
All right. And a lot more to follow up on after a short break. As you know, Professor Lessig, there are plenty of people who say money in politics is not that big a problem. So we'll talk about that after a break. We'll start taking your calls, too. So join us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. And more with Professor Lawrence Lessig after a short break.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and more with Harvard professor Lawrence Lessig on The Exchange on NHPR. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy, scattered showers and some thunderstorms, highs from 65 degrees from the White Mountains north, ranging to 75 degrees in southern parts of the state. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, scattered showers gradually ending overnight, lows 55 to 60. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sunshine, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, highs 75 to 80 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the NEEF Network Organizations, a statewide leader assisting students and parents planning for college. Information at nhheaf.org. And waste management, with a reminder, new energy-efficient CFL bulbs contain mercury and need to be recycled properly. Details on bulb recycling at thinkgreenfromhome.com. This program was recorded earlier. We won't be taking any new phone calls this morning.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're talking with Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig about his new book, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Let's hear from you two. 1-800-892-6477. Do you see the problems of money in politics that Professor Lessig outlines, or do you think it's going overboard to say that our republic is lost? How much do you think individual politicians are accountable for corruption? How much do you think they're drawn in against their will into a corrupt system? Our number here on The Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. The email exchange@nhpr.org. Professor Lessig, just a couple more questions for you, and then I do want to go to our caller. So if you're on the line, we'll be right with you. So we talked before the break about systemic corruption. Are politicians completely off the hook here, innocent victims of a corrupt system, or do they bear some responsibility?
Well, I think they, of course, bear complete responsibility for allowing this system of corruption to exist, of course. All I'm saying is that when we recognize the difference between kind of bad people doing bad things and good people doing or allowing bad things to happen, that distinction is critical to understanding why we kind of have the reaction to members of Congress that we do. There's this famous recognition that though everybody hates Congress, they all love their own congressperson. And that's part of the reason, I think, for this. You meet these people, they're great people, they're decent people. They, seem to want to do what they want to do for the right reason. They, may not be your favorite person in the world, but it's hard to see them as slime because they're not. So all I'm saying is, if we recognize sometimes we need to be able to react and to respond not just to slime, but also to good people who are doing bad because of their failure to live up to their obligation to create a system of politics we can trust, then we begin to think differently about how we need to motivate people to respond to them. So when I wrote this book, everybody said to me, you need to show us all the really ugly, horrible criminal corruption that exists inside the system. And I said, well, what if there isn't? What if there isn't that? How do we solve this problem if we don't actually have villains that we can roll out onto stage to get people riled up and get them to do something? And that's what I was trying to do.
Well, and over the 16 years that I have been doing this program, I have spoken to many, many members of Congress and U.S. senators about this issue of campaign finance. And to a person, Professor Lessig, they say, no, that money does not influence my vote. They say that Group A or Group B gives them money because their political philosophies line up. So it's a chicken and an egg issue. You know, the politician says he or she already holds these views and therefore gets the support. Are you saying they hold these views because of the money?
So let's start first with, even if they're right, which I don't believe, but even if they're right, the fact that 75% of Americans believe money buys results in Congress, and therefore they have no confidence in Congress, and therefore they don't participate in the political system, is reason enough to change the system. Even if they're completely supermen, these members of Congress, and completely immune from being influenced by the constant interaction and favors given in exchange or not so directly in exchange for their behavior, even then, these supermen need to realize that we ordinary humans called citizens aren't willing to assume that when they spend 30 to 70% of their time raising money, they're not affected by it. So the first response to these members is, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter if it's not affecting you. It is affecting us. And the fact that it affects us is all the reason in the world for you to change the system. But does it affect them? I think it is undeniable that the money in the system distorts the systems in ways that we absolutely have to respond to. Let's take the most obvious, and I haven't seen anybody who's questioned this, the agenda of Congress. So I, in my book, talk about how in the first 4 months of Congress, you asked yourself, what was the number one issue that dominated Congress's agenda?
You mean this year?
This year. Yeah, we had, you know, two wars, unemployment crisis, still no addressing global warming, lots of questions about health care, a budget crisis, a question of whether the government was going to shut down. So of all those issues, what was the one that dominated Congress's attention? The bank swipe fee controversy. Whether banks, when you use your debit card, got more money, or retailers, when you use your credit card, your debit card, don't have to pay as much. Now, you know, that was an important issue for those two entities. But you ask, why was that the dominant issue that Congress paid attention to? Because as members of Congress play coy with either side, millions of dollars shower down upon them in campaign contributions from either side, trying to woo them to one side or the other. So you begin to recognize, geez, the agenda of Congress is being selected in part as a function of what things will pour money into congressional campaigns. And, you know, if all things were great in the world, you'd say, who cares? But we have a lot of important issues that Congress has got to address. And the idea that this is the issue they waste their time on is, I think, enough, again, to say there's something wrong with the system.
Well, let's get our listeners involved, Professor Lessig. And again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And up first is Sterling in Manchester. Hi, Sterling. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air. Good morning. Oh, Sterling's not there. Sterling, I hope you call back. Let's take a couple emails, if I could. Here's a question from Joe in Walpole. He says, particularly emblematic of the current system is the Supreme Court's decision that money is a form of free speech, which I want to talk to you about, Professor Lessig. But Joe goes on to say, which makes the corollary also true. If you don't have money, you don't have speech. Hence, at least one reason, he says, why we have the Occupy Wall Street movement. Not having money, protesters have no voice in government, so their only option to be heard is to express themselves outside the halls of government. Joe, two good points. Thanks for calling, for emailing us. What do you think, Professor Lessig?
I think it's the right focus to understand what the Occupy Wall Street movement is about, to frame it in this context of our role in the political process. You know, if you ask the question, which contributors do members of Congress pay the most attention to? They pay the most attention to people who max out in contributions to members of Congress. In 2010, 0.05% of Americans maxed out in their contributions to members of Congress, 0.05%. So the Occupy Wall Street are so proud of their, we're the 99%. It's bad marketing. They should be having signs that say, we're the 99.95% who don't have the same kind of voice in government that the 0.05% has, because they're the ones making these contributions. So I think it's exactly right. If we want to talk about what is the message that 99% of Americans could actually agree on as the problem with our government, it's not going to be a message, you know, to the far left or for the Tea Party. It's not going to be a message to the far right. There is a message right in the center, and that message is this corruption has got to end. And the corruption, if it did end, would give all of us a reason to believe there was a reason to be involved in the system rather than standing outside of Wall Street or K Street or 1,200 places around the country right now.
How do you take the first step, though, if you're a member of Congress? You know, you praise Buddy Romer for taking only campaign contributions of, I think it's $100. But, you know, if you take the first step, then you put yourself at a competitive disadvantage compared to the other candidates. So it's hard to be the first one to jump into the water, so to speak.
Well, I think there's a whole series of people who have to take the first step. You know, the first step is a step we citizens take. And we citizens take that step by saying, we're not going to support anybody who does not commit fundamentally to changing the system. So, here we are talking to New Hampshire. New Hampshire is a pretty critical, important place to begin to set the tone for how politics going forward will happen. And if New Hampshire said to, you know, its senators or to its representative or to presidential candidates, we want this issue right at the top of the list and we want to hear what you're going to do about it, that would be extremely important. Now, for a member of Congress, I agree. I actually don't support the strategy that says members of Congress should voluntarily unilaterally disarm in this game. But I think that they do need to absolutely fundamentally commit in public, in pledging, to supporting the kind of change that would change the system. So whether that's, you know, committing to a certain kind of constitutional amendment or committing to supporting a particular kind of small-dollar funded public election system, that's, you know, a detail. The critical point is they say, I agree, this is a critical corruption, I commit to changing it. And then, you know, they get in and then they execute on that. And if they don't actually introduce the bill or vote for the bill or vote for the constitutional resolution, then they ought to be kicked out. But we need to get citizens to first make the demand so that politicians begin to respond to what the citizens say.
Well, the first part of Joe's email says that the Supreme Court has decided that money is a form of free speech. And how do you then change the system that you say is so problematic without stepping on people's rights to free speech? I mean, if I'm a lobbyist, I've got the right to say what I want and tell Congress what I think.
Yeah, I don't. Actually, in anything that I'm describing here, I wouldn't at all be restricting anybody's free speech, right? So when a candidate like Buddy Romer says, I'm only going to take $100, he's exercising his free speech right to associate his campaign with small dollar contributions only so that nobody doubts that he will be, as he says, free to lead. And when I support small-dollar funded elections the way Maine has or Connecticut has or Arizona has. My book has a slightly different version, but it's a detail. That's not restricting anybody's free speech. What that's saying is candidates should be able to fund their campaigns with small-dollar contributions voluntarily. They opt into that system. They shouldn't be forced into a system where the only way they can fund their campaigns is to turn to Wall Street financiers to fund them. So that, again, is their free speech, exercising their free speech right. So nobody's quashing free speech rights. There was, of course, a history in the past where people thought the solution to campaign finance was just to silence people or to stop them from speaking. I think the Supreme Court's basically said that's not a viable solution. So we need another solution where we can fund elections without the tiniest slice of America having unbelievable disproportionate power in this process.
Here's an analysis of campaign finance regulation from the Cato Institute, and it says money is of much greater value to challengers than incumbents, so higher spending opens up the political system to new people and new ideas. What do you think about that, Professor Lessig, the idea that if I'm the incumbent, everybody knows who I am already? If I'm the challenger, I need lots of money to put myself out there.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And I think that challengers do need a lot of money. But the existing system doesn't bias in favor of the challengers. To the contrary, if all of the money is coming from the tiniest slice that are trying to leverage their power by leveraging campaign funding, that funding goes primarily to the incumbents. It doesn't go to challengers. So the alternative system that I'm talking about is a system where the challengers actually have a much better opportunity to raise money than the incumbents. And in the public funding systems we've seen in Arizona and Maine and Connecticut, challengers actually do better, not substantially better, but better than they do under the large dollar funded systems that we've had before. And the critical reason for this is the people in the middle, the lobbyists, right? Now, in my utopia, there are still lobbyists, but they're lobbyists as policy wonks. They're not lobbyists serving the function as channels through which campaign funds get passed to candidates or directed to go to candidates. You know, and the reason for that is, you know, as John Edwards used to say when we used to quote John Edwards, there's all the difference in the world between a lawyer making an argument to a jury and a lawyer handing out $100 bills to the jurors. And the problem with our lobbying system is it can't distinguish between those two. And so what we need is a lobbying system where the lobbyists are there just for the purpose of giving Congress information, which is critical, but not for the purpose of making themselves the makers inside of Washington so that they have such disproportionate influence, and that disproportionate influence gets leveraged most effectively with the incumbents.
Let's take a couple more calls. And David is calling from Laconia. Hi, David. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Laura. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I guess mine, it's more of a comment than anything at this point. You know, I listen to the show every morning, and I listen to, you know, the news, and I guess as an average person, I don't know who to vote for because of my suspicion and because of my cynicism. I'm incredibly suspicious and of the way things are running Congress, and watching how much Congress struggles to get along just to come to agreement on major issues. You know, I guess it's frustrating because how does one person, you know, impact the way things are going? You know, honestly, my vote is going to be my vote, no matter who it's for, but you can't really decide who it's going to be for.
You sound disheartened, David. Really, like you've lost some hope here.
Oh, it's, you know, I listen to it every morning, and it's every day I get more and more suspicious and more frustrated that our founding fathers did not see things going this way. They can't even come to agreement on, you know, anything. And we listen to it every single day. It's getting more and more frustrated, and I'm likely to vote for Ralph Nader this time around. I don't know.
Well, David, thanks a lot for calling in. What do you think, Professor Lessig? And then I have another question for you, too.
Well, I certainly agree that people have a legitimate reason to be cynical and frustrated. You know, the latest poll by New York Times CBS found 9% of Americans with confidence in Congress. You know, and you have to begin to wonder, at what point does the institution just have to declare bankruptcy? You know, 9%, you can't get much lower than that, right? It was certainly the case at the time of the Revolution that the British Crown had more support than our Congress has today. So, you know, I just want to know what the institution thinks it has to do when it's facing a public that doesn't begin to have any trust in it at all. Now, the response to that, I agree, one person alone can't do anything. But we're beginning to see grassroots movements on the left and the right that if they were mature enough about recognizing what the real potential here is, could begin to unite around a framework that said this source of this cynicism has got to be removed. It's got to be cut out. And they cut it out by not having the corrupt system for funding elections that we have right now. And once we cut it out, then people can listen to what's going on, and rather than thinking there's nothing I can do, they can think, well, I've got to get involved involved in the democratic way to change the way government is going, and I have a reason to get involved because I know that if I'm involved, there is some chance it will have an effect, as opposed to whatever I do, it doesn't matter. The corporate interests will have so much power and buy the result they want.
But, you know, is it, and I hear David's dismay, I've heard it from other callers as well, but is it money that is putting Congress at loggerheads, members of Congress at loggerheads with each other? Or is it partisan posturing, hardened partisan lines, gerrymandering that makes districts super red or super blue? I mean, is money really why Republicans and Democrats can't get along?
So I spend a bajillion pages in my book trying to show how, in fact, all of these issues are tied together. So think about the polarization issue. The polarization issue is driven in significant parts by the need to raise money. So on the issues where our parties are not polarized, what do we do to Wall Street? It makes sense that they're not polarized because Wall Street's got all the money and they're giving, and what songs the Democrats and Republicans are singing are exactly the songs Wall Street wants to hear. But on the social issues, how do you get people really excited to send money into your campaign? Be as extreme as you can in your direction about the social issues, whether it's gay rights or abortion. Just be as extreme as you can, and then the people who really care about those issues send the most money into your campaigns. The same thing with gerrymandering. Yeah, we've got a significant problem that at least 85% of seats in the country, in the House, are safe seats, meaning seats where the party is the only determinant, so the primary is the only choice about who gets to run. But in those seats, too, the safest way to continue to be able to raise the money you need, not just for yourself, but for your party, because both parties tax members to raise money to fund other elections, is to, again, sing to the extremes. Now, if we could tone down the demand, the drive for that kind of fundraising, and instead have a kind of system which raised money without the pressure that the existing system does, I think we might be able to get back to a different kind of Congress. And I guess that's the final, you know, you can work through the thousand different examples I put into my book, but here's a much simpler point, right? We can see dramatic change in one dimension in Congress over the past 25 years. That is fundraising. And we've seen Congress become more and more dysfunctional over the past 25 years. Shouldn't we at least try to unwind the first and see if it has some connection to the second?
All right. And David, thanks for that call. And thanks for listening, by the way. We will be back after a short break, so stay with us.
I'm Betsy Gardella, President and CEO of NHPR. On June 30th, we close our books on the fiscal year. We're already planning the news coverage you've come to expect from us through the summer, the election season, and well beyond. But we need your help to meet our year-end goal. Your donation today will help us end this fiscal year strong. Call 1-888-805-NHPR or visit nhpr.org to make a gift. Thanks.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, the generation gap in economic, social, and political issues. New Hampshire weather today, mostly cloudy, scattered showers and some thunderstorms. Highs today from 65 degrees from the White Mountains north, ranging to about 75 degrees in southern areas of the state. Tonight, partly to mostly cloudy, scattered showers gradually ending in the overnight and lows 55 to 60. Tomorrow, mix of clouds and sunshine, chance of a shower or thunderstorm, highs from 75 to 80 degrees. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Antioch University New England, introducing the new part-time MBA in sustainability with multiple start dates this fall for its online and on-campus classes. AntiochNE.edu. MBAE Systems, remembering our servicemen and women and emergency response professionals in their commitment to our country and communities on this Independence Day. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, we're taking a look at campaign finance in a new book by Harvard Law Professor Lawrence Lessig called Republic Lost: How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange at nhpr.org. And Professor Lessig, let's go right back to our callers. And Seth is calling in from Concord. Hi, Seth. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Lawrence. Representative Seth Cohn. I'm a state rep representing six towns just north of Concord. And I have to say, I absolutely agree with Professor Lessig. I mean, I'm a Republican. I'm involved with Occupy New Hampshire. And I think he's right on the money.
Go ahead, Seth.
I think there's no question that the system today is not responsive to the people, and most of it is about the money. The reason I specifically called in, not just to agree, but I think that Professor Lessig's previous book, all about free culture and about copyright, is a perfect example. When Mickey Mouse was going to go into the public domain, suddenly there was all of this money that changed copyright laws. And every time Mickey Mouse has come near expiring, suddenly there's all this money to modify copyright again. And clearly that's all about the money.
You know, I'm interested, Seth, because you are a state representative. Have you found fundraising pressures even at your level, even in little old New Hampshire?
Well, you know, with the state reps, because it's only paid $100 a year, you'd think we would, but I think the balance factor there is that there are 400 of us.
Right.
It becomes very hard to lobby 400. However, I would say New Hampshire State Senate, absolutely. I think they are far more responsive to the lobbyists than they are to the people. They're constantly looking forward to the next election and looking to, exactly as Professor Lessig said, who's going to pay the bills? Because to run for state senate is, what, $100,000 minimum?
Which does seem a little crazy in a small state like this.
Especially for a job that pays $100 a year.
Seth, thanks a lot for calling. And, you know, Professor Lessig, Seth's point relates to an email that I received before the program from Regina, who says, in your book, you focus on the federal scene. Regina says, shouldn't we be working at all levels with efforts in the states that would be complementary to those in Washington? Regina says, in New Hampshire, for instance, a bill has been submitted which would substantially improve disclosure and transparency of political contributions. Similar laws already exist in some states, and efforts to introduce them are underway. What's your view, Regina says? So go ahead and comment, if you could, Professor Lessig, both on Seth's ideas on the local scene and Regina's ideas.
Well, the most important thing that, I mean, I'm heartened by what Seth said, but the most important thing that he said is he was a Republican supporting the Occupy New Hampshire movement. Now, that's critical because I think we've got to find a way for people on all sides of the political spectrum to begin to talk about this fundamental issue. And so to imagine a representative who's, you know, obviously this movement has connotations that associate with the left more strongly than the right, to be willing to stand up publicly and say, I want to talk and be involved in this movement is critically important. And number two, you know, I'm happy and sad that he would affirm that this is the way the system is. I'm happy because I'm, you know, an academic and I want to be right. I'm sad because I wish somebody would prove me wrong. It is interesting with 400 representatives how New Hampshire can feel a little bit differently in the House of Representatives. That's led many people to think maybe we need to just increase the number of representatives at the federal level. And I'm not sure that that's actually a solution, but I'm happy to consider it after we
address... It's an interesting idea, actually. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah. After we address the fundamental issue, which is just the influences people have to respond to in order to raise the money. So I'm extremely heartened by that. Now, as to the question, should we be thinking about it at all levels? Yes, absolutely. But I think there's a sequence issue here. What solution would be generative? What problem, if we could solve it, would actually help us solve other problems too? So I'm happy if people in New Hampshire think about the federal level, the presidential race, and the state level, all three of those things. But if you've got one thing you're going to think about it in the context where it would have the most direct impact. And I think that, you know, the thing I've been extremely happy that Connecticut, Maine, and Arizona have tried these systems, but state government is not as prominent in people's view as federal government, at least for many important issues. For some, obviously, education in particular is critical. And I think that we need to, at the federal level, solve this enough so that people can begin to restore their trust in the system so that our skepticism and cynicism about government doesn't bleed over into every single part of our experience.
Now, Regina raises a point, again, that I have heard before from members of Congress and from those who think that that we don't need to clamp down on money in politics. She says, what about disclosure and transparency? I've talked to a lot of politicians who say, look, the amounts don't matter. As long as voters know that I'm getting money from, you know, A, B, C, and D, that's good enough.
Yeah, I'm...
The transparency argument.
Yeah, I don't believe that's true. Which is not to say I don't believe disclosure is important. Of course it's important. But what disclosure actually does, especially when you add it to some of the fantastic tools that groups like Sunlight Foundation or MapLight, MoneyInPoliticsLight.org, which I'm actually on the board of it. But after you add disclosure to these fantastic tools, we have a very super computer-like way to show you the relationship between influence and results. And what does that do? It makes people more cynical. So I think disclosure is important. It's critically important. But we need to tie that to a reform movement, right? So you know, remember when the Deepwater Horizon had its disaster and somebody installed a HD webcam in the under the water so we could see the sludge pouring out into the Gulf. That was important. It's really important to be able to see this, to be reminded about the sludge pouring into the Gulf. But That's not the solution. The solution is to stop the sludge from pouring into the Gulf. So I'm happy to have a camera there to tell us whether we solve the problem or not. But I want to solve the problem, which is the sludge, which is stopped by having a funding system where we don't rely on the 0.05% of America to fund campaigns that we all depend upon.
Well, a lot of people, especially, again, those in the quarters of power, don't think that there is a problem. Again, you know, if I know that Lawrence Lessig gets money from, you know, these groups and Laura Kanoy gets money from those groups, I can vote for Laura Kanoy and not Lawrence Lessig. So they really don't think that the dollar amounts are a problem.
Yeah, but if you think that the dollar amounts are making me as a representative shapeshift to benefit the funder, then you might very well think, why should I bother? I don't have as much influence in this game as the funder. So you might say, oh, yeah, I know that this is a Exxon-supported candidate, so I'll vote for the other side. Assuming there is another side, again, in the financial services case, both sides were taking money from Wall Street. Both sides walked down the path of creating this financial disaster because Wall Street had enough money to go around to both sides. So we don't even have a choice in that case. But even where we do have a choice, you can still say it doesn't matter because they have the loudest and most powerful influence relative to me, and so I'm not going to be involved. So disclosure is important, but disclosure is never going to be enough.
Let's go to Bill in Concord. Bill, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with Professor Lessig.
Yes, Professor, you're right on the money, pun intended. Congress, an earlier caller said that Congress doesn't agree on much. Well, they do agree on campaign funding. They all feed from the same trough, and they feed greedily. An example I wanted to point out was the government of Israel and their lobby. They asked for $2 million. They get the money. 25% of it comes back in kickbacks. This has been going on for 50 or 60 years. And when they ask for another $2 million, they push each other out of the way to bring it to the floor for a vote, and it's almost unanimous. They grease both sides of the aisle. In the Philippines, they are taxing campaign contributions. I don't know how they pulled it off. We could probably never pull it off here. And it's overseen by the IRS there. And hence, the Congress didn't write the laws. There are no loopholes. Let me know your thoughts on that, please.
Bill, I want to ask you a quick question if I could.
Go ahead.
You know, members of Congress would say, hey, you know, we give money to Israel because it is the only democracy that we can count on in the Middle East, and that is worth supporting. You're saying, Bill, no, that's not why they give Israel money. They give Israel money because Israel gives money right back? Is that what you're saying?
They've got to say that. Yeah, they're better off than we are over there.
Okay, Lawrence, let's like jump in.
They've got universal health care. They've got money coming out of their noses.
Yeah, first, let's be clear. Bill, when you're talking about two, you're talking about $2 billion with a B, not million with an M. So you're right. There's a lot of money on the table, and there's been a question about exactly how that money gets influenced. But I think the critical point is, it might be because this is extremely important democracy to support. It might be because of the money. We need a system where we don't have to wonder. We need a system where we know why we're doing what we're doing, and it's not because of the money. That's the deep cynicism that we need to find some way to get out of. Now, what would the alternative be, taxing campaign contributions? I that just increases the amount of money people would have to raise. I think, the solution is a kind of small dollar funded system. And I've pointed to Maine, Connecticut, and Arizona. My own view, my own version in my book says, look, let's everybody who's a voter contributes at least $50 to the federal treasury. So let's say we're going to rebate that first $50 in the form of a democracy voucher that you can contribute to any candidate you want as long as that candidate agrees only to take democracy vouchers plus, again, because of my hero buddy, to take contributions up to $100 from any citizen. So you fund your campaigns with $100 contributions or democracy vouchers. Those two things together would be the sole source of your money, no PAC money, nothing beyond that, just those two sources. And if you ran your campaign and we had a majority of Congress elected under that system, nobody could believe money was driving the results there. Now, that system, $50 a voter, would produce at least $6 billion into the election system. In 2010, there was only $1.8 billion raised and spent by everybody in the election system. So that's real money that would create an alternative to the existing large dollar funded system that would give people a reason to believe in what Congress is doing, as opposed to constantly wondering, is what they're doing because of the money, or is what they're doing because it makes sense for democracy?
So a $50 voucher, it wouldn't be $50 of my own money. It would be $50 that I would get from the federal government to give as a campaign contribution to whoever I want.
Right. Well, your own money? I mean, it is your money that you gave to the federal government, rebated to you. So it's your money. The critical reason I wanted to do it like this is lots of people on the right, for legitimate reasons, I don't believe it, but for legitimate reasons, say, I don't like public funding because I don't like my money being used to support somebody I don't believe in.
Right.
Okay, fine. It's not your money. My $50 is my support. Your $50 is your support. But you get that voucher to allocate to candidates who agree to opt into the system where that's the only money they're taking. And if we had that system, we could begin to fight back against this debilitating cynicism that all of us have about this government.
What's been the reaction to this $50 voucher idea? I've seen a couple of remarks, Professor Lessig, to be honest, kind of look at it skeptically and say, A, it wouldn't work, and B, no one would adopt it even if it did work.
Well, you know, I guess I want to throw the question back to people. You know, if you believe the system is corrupted, and if you believe that this corruption produces the cynicism and the lack of involvement, then I'm not committed to my answer. Give me another answer. Give me another way to get people involved, to fund elections in a way that gets us to a place that we can believe what they're saying is a function of what they believe, as opposed to what they believe they need to say in order to raise money. So the $50 voucher system is a slight modification of the other small dollar funded systems. I think small dollar funded systems are better than the government deciding, you know, you in this district get $1 million and you in that district get $2 million. But I'm happy to listen to alternatives, just I'm not happy to listen to people who say, geez, nothing's going to work, let's just keep the existing system, because we cannot survive as a republic with this system. Our government cannot address the most fundamental issues, whether you think it's global warming or the financial services sector or a tax system or healthcare. We can't address those systems given the institutionalized stalemate that has been built into our system because of the way we fund our elections.
Let's take one more call, if it could, Professor Lessig. Mary in Northwood. Go ahead, Mary, you're on the air.
Hi, Laura. It's good to talk with you both this morning, Professor Lessig. I want to propose an alternative solution. You just invited people to do that.
Go ahead, Mary.
I heard Representative Cohen earlier make the point that in New Hampshire, it's very hard for lobbying interests to have the kind of power over the legislature that they might have elsewhere because our legislature is so big. And Professor Lessig responded with speculating about the idea that maybe it would make sense to increase the size of Congress and reduce the power of lobbyists that way over the national government. But what I would suggest is that if New Hampshire's way of going about it works so well with representative democracy being so close to the people, why ought we not then to insist that our government be more local, turn less of the decision-making and the regulation-making and so forth, and the money collecting, the tax collecting, over to a national system where there are 400 Congress people, after all.
So make government decision-making and programs and all and so forth, Mary, more local, more state-based?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Right. Why shouldn't education decisions be made here instead of, you know, through the federal government by virtue of thousand-page bills and 2,000-page bills like No Child Left Behind? Why shouldn't healthcare decision-making be in our state legislature if it's going to be governmental at all?
Okay. Mary, in the interest of time, I'm going to let you go because we've got just about a minute left. Professor Lessig, what do you think? Government closer to the people works best.
So it might be right. It might make sense to have smaller federal government, more local decisions. I know a lot of political philosophies push that, libertarianism, federalism, all of that's possibly the right thing to do. But the thing to recognize is that you can't just assume the solution. You've got to tell me how we get to that solution. And under the existing system, Congress has an interest in keeping as much power and control in Washington as they can, because the more things they touch, either through regulation or through special tax benefits, the more people whose chain they can pull when it comes time to fund their elections. So if you want to, you know, if you want to get your additional tax benefit continued for 2 years, then you're going to have to help us to make sure we've got the right kind of support. So therefore, run a fundraiser for us so that we can actually fund our campaigns. These are all because Congress is in the business of not only governing the country and raising tax revenue for the country, but also governing their campaigns and raising the money they need for their campaigns. So I would love to have a system where we could have a fair fight about the question whether we should have local control or more control in Washington. A fair fight on the merits, not a fair fight that is skewed by the constant recognition of Congress that they need as much power so that they can fund their campaigns as efficiently as they can.
Well, Professor Lessig, lots to chew on this hour. Thank you very much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Lawrence Lessig, director of the Edmund J. Safra Center for Ethics at Harvard University, a professor of law at Harvard Law School, and author of the new book we talked about, Republic Lost, How Money Corrupts Congress and a Plan to Stop It. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Ryan Lassard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our earlier conversation about one doctor's quest for the best care possible at the end of life. Dartmouth physician Ira Byock says far too many Americans suffer needlessly and die badly. In a new book, Byock calls for a